who, like other human beings, had to struggle with the common frailties of human nature to arrive at the state of an enlightened one. He walked among us for 45 years as a wise, compassionate human teacher, sharing his realization with others and ensuring that his teachings would remain in the world after his death. And then he says, since this corresponds closely with contemporary agnostic attitudes towards the ideals of religious faith, it has an immediate appeal to those of us nurtured by modern modes of thought. The Buddha was a man as we are men, and taught the Dharma. But then Bhikkhu Bodhi says, if you look at what the texts themselves say about the Buddha, it's something much bigger than that. He says, if you take seriously the text's own account of the background to the Buddha in the world, they ascribe to his mission nothing short of a cosmic scope. Against the background of a universe with no conceivable bounds in time, a universe within which living beings are enveloped in the darkness of ignorance, wandering along, bound to suffering of old age, sickness and death, the Buddha arrives bringing the light of wisdom. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying there's a cosmic perspective in the texts. In a sense, that's the element that comes in this naturalist story of the Enlightenment. Another element comes in, Brahma Sahampati appears. At the moment of the Buddha teaching, the event reverberates up through the various heavens, the gods are celebrating. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, if you're taking the text seriously, you have to have both of those perspectives in mind. He says, a correct view of the Buddha can only arise from the merging of these two perspectives. To hold these two perspectives in balance without one cancelling out the other. It's a completely pragmatic human practice, and it's got this cosmic perspective to it, something of significance for the whole of reality, according to the early Buddhist texts themselves. So a second story, and again, very well-known story of the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha is visiting the Kalamas in Kesaputta. And this lovely little story where the Kalamas arrive to talk to the Buddha. I remember doing a seminar on this with Bhante. And he's saying that they all arrive in their various ways. Some of them prostrate themselves, some of them bow, some of them just sit down without any greeting. And Bhante made a wee bit of a thing in this. He's just saying how flexible the Buddha is. There's no particular etiquette. You don't have to prostrate full length. In a way, people respond as they're moved. Maybe that gives you a wee bit of a flavour of what's to come. But yes, this lovely little description of the elders of Kesaputta say that, look, great to have you in the village. Always nice to have a visiting spiritual teacher. We get quite a lot of you guys. And one of the things that we've noticed, they say, is that the ascetics and Brahmins who come elucidate their own doctrines and disparage, debunk, revile and vilify the doctrines of others. And then others, ascetics, come. They too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, disparage, debunk, revile and vilify the doctrines of others. And the elders of Kesaputta says, for us, venerable sir, this creates perplexity and doubt as to which of these good aesthetics speaks the truth and which of them speaks falsehood. So they basically say to the Buddha, how do we tell which religious teachers are telling the truth? So you get this famous response of the Buddha, who says that you don't go by logic, you don't go by lineage, you don't go by inferential reasoning, reason cogitation, the acceptance of a view after pondering it, the competence of the speaker because you agree with it or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. None of those, he says, are grounds for accepting something as true. And then he says, when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome. These things are blamable. These things are censured by the wise. These things, if practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you abandon them. So famous enough little text. But Bhikkhu Bodhi's commentary on this is how distinctive it is in Buddhism the emphasis it gives to testing things in your own direct experience. He says that one of the distinctive features of Buddhism is the emphasis it places on your own experience as a basis for judgment. Then he makes a very interesting point. He says that it's not that the whole range of Buddhist teaching is easily verified in your experience. If you're talking about enlightenment, it's a big deal. It's an extraordinary experience. But what he says is that at the beginning of practice, you're asked to focus on these things that it's possible to verify in your own experience, and that you can deepen your practice step by step, verifying your experience as you go, until you can start to have the confidence of it's worked this far. You're more inclined to trust some of the sort of deeper teachings, some of the teachings that are a little bit out of your immediate experience. But that idea that the Buddha himself focuses on what's verifiable, what you can rely on in your own experience, what you know in your own experience to be true, is the sort of starting point for practice, starting point for how we test the Dharma. So this brings us on, coming back to the content of the Buddha's experience of paticca-samuppada and conditionality. And this is absolute classic central Buddhism. So, as I say, that text that I was quoting earlier is the Buddha himself, early in his career, describing the content of his experience. So he's saying, well, in a way it's beyond conceptual thought, but if I had to describe it, the conceptual language I would use to describe it is conditionality, dependent arising. Things arise in dependence on conditions. And just to, the interest, I think, just to stop and to think about why the Buddha himself sort of focused on that as the central teaching. But one of the things that Subhuti says in Revering and Relying on the Dharma is that it's not philosophical. In a sense, paticca-samuppada is not a view. It's back to this thing of something that you can verify in your own experience. So what's being said is that every object of experience, whether it's something in the world around us, whether it's our bodies, whether it's a feeling, whether it's a mental state, everything that you look at comes into being dependent on conditions that precede it. And that event becomes a condition for something that follows it. And what the tradition is saying, there's a little phrase from Life, Liberation Through Naked Awareness by Padmasambhava, who just says, look into your own mind and see if this is true. So sit down, become aware of your sensations, notice if they're changing or not, and the Buddhist bet is that they are. You look at a mental state, look into your own mind, is it changing or not? And everything that you look at, according to the Buddhist tradition, has this characteristic of coming into being dependent on conditions and becoming the condition for what follows it. So it's not a view in the sense that it's not a theory about the nature of reality. It's something, again, that's verifiable in moment-to-moment experience. But what Subhuti in his paper goes on to say is that a lot follows from this. So what he says is, what's conditioned can't be permanent. So this famous set of teachings of the three Lakshanas in the Buddhist tradition, it said the three marks of conditioned existence, the clear seeing of which constitutes insight. And the first one is that everything that you look at is impermanent. If things arise in dependence on conditions, there's nothing that's stable and permanent. Look into your mind and see if this is true. Second one is, what's impermanent can offer permanent satisfaction. Right, Sangharakshita says somewhere that the human tragedy is that we look for permanent satisfaction from things that are in themselves impermanent. So it's not that all existence is painful. A lot of existence is pleasurable, but just nothing's the basis for permanent satisfaction. So the second mark, the second lakshana, is this mark of dukkha, that nothing is the basis for permanent satisfaction. And the third one, third of the lakshanas, is anatta, that if everything arises dependent on conditions, there's no stable fixed self anywhere in your experience. So if you look at your experience, you never come to a nut that's permanently, irreducibly you. And it's not that you don't have your own character, it's not that you don't have your own strengths, your own weaknesses, your own characteristics. All of that's true. The experience is real. But there's nothing in there that's a fixed, independent, unchanging essence. So that follows from everything arises in dependence on conditions. So anyway, so far, so straightforward. Second thing comes out of it. One of the things that the tradition says, you get these very careful descriptions in the Buddhist tradition called the Nidanas. And the Nidanas describe in pedantic detail how what arises from the condition before it and what follows from that. So what Subhuti says about this is that reality isn't random, that there's a pattern to it. There's a connection between one event and the event that follows it. The Buddhist formula for this is this being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. That there's an order, and even a predictable order, to how conditionality unpacks itself. And we're back to the Dhammapada, back to these two verses. Bhante again said somewhere that to practice the Dharma, you don't need to know very much Dharma. You don't need to know the ins and outs of Buddhist philosophy. He said you can get by on a couple of verses of the Dhammapada. And if that's true, it's these couple of verses that it's getting at. So conditionality within our own minds, one of the briefest descriptions of it is the description we gave a couple of nights ago, that experiences are preceded by mind, led by the mind, produced by the mind. When we speak and act with an impure mind, suffering follows like a cart follows an ox. When we speak and act with a pure mind, happiness follows as close as our own shadow. And what that's saying is, first of all, that within our own minds, that process of conditionality is observable. When you speak and act with an impure mind, suffering follows. When you speak and act with a pure mind, happiness follows. And again, this is not metaphysics, so Padmasambhava's invitation, look into your own mind and see if this is true. So first of all, conditionality unfolds within our own mind. But the second point that's made is that there are two kinds of conditionality. If we act out of confusion, out of craving, it leads to painful mental states. If we act out of awareness, if we act out of compassion, it leads to happy mental states. So that there's a two patterns within conditionality. And Subhuti says something about this that really, really struck me. His generalisation from this is that liberation, like any other phenomenon, enlightenment, like any other phenomenon, arises in dependence on conditions. Liberation is possible because there are currents within the flow of conditionality that lead in the direction of enlightenment. Currents within our own mind that lead in the direction of enlightenment. And what he says, spiritual practice essentially consists in active cooperation with those natural currents within our own mind that lead in the direction of enlightenment. So it's not that we're having to will enlightenment into being. It's there's something that's part of the nature of your mind. To the extent that you set up certain conditions, there's a natural unfolding of a momentum towards liberation. That's part of the nature of things. It's something that you can have complete confidence in, that if you set the conditions up lawfully, naturally, certain consequences follow. If you speak and act with a pure mind, happiness follows as close as our own shadow. So There are a number of ways of describing this natural unfolding process, but I think this idea that what you're trying to do is to cooperate with that natural process, to me, is quite a significant one for practice. The classical one, the classical way of talking about it, is in terms of the 12 positive nidanas, where you get this unfolding process. Another way of talking about it is the seven factors of enlightenment. You could probably get any number of lists that describe this unfolding process. And the one I'm most familiar with, the one I'm most familiar with in my own experience, is probably the one that the Anapanasati Sutta goes through. I want just to spend a little bit of time on this, because I think this idea of a natural unfolding process, again, something that you can verify in your own experience. From the Anapanasati Sutta, it tells you to be aware of the breath, aware of the body, aware of calm, aware of pleasure, aware of bliss, and aware of the mind gladdening, aware of the mind becoming liberated, and aware of the mind steadying. So I suppose I just wanted to, some of you are going to be familiar with that framework, right? But for all of us, if you sit down, even if you do it right now, take awareness onto your breath and just sort of stop for a minute. Good idea for me, actually, just stop for a minute, aware of my breath. I listen to recordings of my own talks sometimes and I get breathless just listening because I never seem to actually stop. So awareness onto the breath, awareness onto the body. And what tends to happen in meditation is as you take awareness into your body relaxes. You know, like usually we carry slightly habitual tensions. Awareness goes in there and without you having to do much, there's a little bit of a releasing, a softening. So that anybody can remember that or check it out in your experience now. So this idea of awareness on the breath and the body, calm naturally arises. You don't have to make your body calm. You take awareness into the calm and it's got an emotional flavour to it. And the emotional flavour is, on the whole, calm is a relief. There's an element, to some extent, of pleasure in it. So you can't will the pleasure. All you can do is pay attention to the calm, pay attention to the emotional flavour of it. And on the whole, the body releasing and relaxing is quite pleasurable. And then what's said is if you take awareness onto the pleasure that's there, the pleasure tends to get stronger. So one of the wee aphorisms from the Majjhima Nikaya, I think, is whatever you give attention to, a positive experience you give attention to tends to intensify. What you give attention to becomes more real. So in the Anapanasati Sutta, you're getting a description of a process that you take attention to. It's almost like you clear the space and you allow that process to start to naturally unfold. And just sort of seeing that, getting a sense of that, that as you take awareness into experience, you set up conditions that allow this natural current towards liberation get its space and start to move. So again, just this idea of liberation is possible because there are flows within, currents within the flow that lead in the direction of enlightenment. It sounds kind of ambitious, it sounds again sort of metaphysical, but just wanting to make that point, it's, you can see it without looking too deeply into our own experience. And one of the points Subhuti makes is that one of the foundations for successful practice is the confidence that comes when you recognise that tendency within your own experience. If you know that you set the conditions up, something naturally arises. It's a tremendous ground for confidence in one's practice. And so the question then is, how do you do that? So I've used the example of the Anapanasati Sutta. But in a sense, that conditionality, that cooperation with the currents that lead to liberation is what the whole of the Dharma is about. So I wanted to talk about this second point, that to really effectively work with that, we have to start to focus on taking some practices deeper. In a sense, the whole of the Dharma gives you access to that broad principle of something deeper arising out of conditions. To be practical about it, you've got to start to work with specific practices. So I want to come to the Dharma within Sri Ratna and how we tend to approach it. And this is based on, over the last few years, since 2009, Banti and Subbuti have been involved in these conversations and trying to kind of re-articulate some of the real basics of the Sri Ratna approach, even clarify some of the basics of the Sri Ratna approach. I live in the same building as Sangharakshita. I've lived with Sangharakshita for the last sort of 14 years or something like that. But, you know, definitely now, at his 88th birthday, August 26th, and you're definitely looking at somebody who's looking his age, actually. He's much more withdrawn, much older than he was. I think it'll be a surprise if there are many more of these conversations that he's got the energy to engage in. So he's been concerned, I think, getting towards the end of his life, to try and sum up the main elements of the teaching. And in one of the papers called Initiation into a New Life, Subbuti kind of revisits some material that go all the way back to 1979, I think, a lecture that Banti gave called The System of Meditation. And in the System of Meditation, even at that time, so Banti by that time would have been about 10 years back from Kalimpong, so 10 years back from studying with some very, very distinguished Tibetan teachers, mainly Nyingma teachers. And a friend of mine did a count once, and he said that even at that time, there were probably something like 30-odd meditations actively being done within the order 10 years after its founding. And it's the same thing. You've got such a wealth of material, it's sometimes hard to see how it all hangs together and how the practices support each other. So what Sangharakshita said that he was trying to do in that lecture, now obviously I think sort of there's a definite flavour to a lot of Banti's writing, quite apart from the fact that his prose style is mainly Edwardian English. But leaving that aside, he's something very provisional, very modest about Banti's writing, believe it or not. So in this lecture, he says, I wanted to take up the different methods of meditation current in the order, and I wanted to see in which way they link into what I have called, he says, a trifle ambitiously, a system. And I think that sort of modesty around the system, the provisionality around the system, is a significant thing, actually. So what he's called a trifle ambitiously, a system. And then he says it needs to be clear, if you're practicing, how the practices are related. And what you need is an arrangement of practice that lets you see how they're related and lets you see how your practice can take you forward step by step and stage by stage. We need to make clear the progressive, cumulative nature of spiritual practice. And basically, it's just another way of saying you start off aware of the breath and the body, and your practice is gradually deepening into a clear seeing of the nature of things. So how do the practices that we do within this community support that deepening process? So I want to say a little bit about that. So the framework that Subbuti's been talking about for the last few years, you will be tired of hearing about, of integration, positive emotions, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity. But I want to say just a little bit more about the roots of those. I don't think it's obvious from some of the more recent discussions, but you see it if you go back to the 79 lectures, that framework's built on the five spiritual faculties. It's built on mindfulness, shraddha and positive emotion, vision or insight is what Banti's translating as spiritual death. Samadhi, transformation, is what's been translated as spiritual rebirth. And virya is what's been translated as spiritual receptivity. And I think that For me, that's a significant thing. It's not an arbitrary system. It's not something that's been plucked out of the air. Five spiritual faculties are one of the earliest descriptions of the nature of spiritual experience. One of the things that's been said is that spiritual experience is it's a whole organic, balanced experience. I think a lot of the language these days around insight tends to be very cognitive. We tend to think about insight in terms of something seen intellectually, something seen philosophically. I think one of the things that the five spiritual faculties is trying to say is that it's richer than that and broader than that, and that your practice needs to be more full than just something cognitive. So what you've got in the first stage is this idea of awareness and integration. And it's just starting off as simple as it possibly can, saying before you do anything else in spiritual practice, you're connecting with your experience just as it is. And you know, like something like the Satipatthana Sutta makes this just so clear. You're aware of your body and what your body's doing. But, you know, sit down, do the mindfulness of breathing. And I don't know if you get the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy over here, but British comedy called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and there was a character in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy who was having a trial separation from his body. And I think for a lot of Brits that's true. Like, a lot of us are having trial separations from our body. And just sitting down, connecting what your body's doing, connecting to the vitality and the energy of your body, just plugging into the basic fact of being alive is where your spiritual practice starts. And then broadening out, connecting to how you feel, noticing what you think, you know, just being awake to the basic experience of being alive is what awareness and integration is talking about. And then what, in Banti's framework, the next stage is positive emotion. And I think just this idea, so first of all, spiritual experience has got this element of connectedness to yourself and to the world round about you. Second thing that you're looking for in spiritual practice is a positive element of positive emotion. Basically, to some extent, in your practice, you ought to be becoming happier. And even if it's just more capacity to be with your pain, if you know what I mean, there's a certain sort of willingness and availability to your experience, whatever it is. So that, first of all, and then secondly, a bit more, well, compassion, for want of a better word, kindness, friendliness, that loosening of self-absorption and a little bit more awareness of other is an intrinsic part of your spiritual practice and something that you want to be given conscious attention to developing. The main practice that we use for that, obviously, is metta bhavana, although things like ritual, things like communication with other people are important practices. So the third area is this one of spiritual death. Banti obviously had a particular emphasis that he wanted to make in spiritual death, but more traditional language for it, to go back to the five spiritual faculties, would be prajna, gets translated as insight. But the main element of insight is back to the lakshanas. It's recognising that if you look more deeply, look more carefully at your own experience, that the whole thing is a flow of conditioned experience, that there's nothing fixed that you're stuck in. You start to take awareness into your experience, the whole thing is open and fluid, more open, more fluid than you realised. And the main practice that we do for this is a practice called six element practice. And we tend not to do it until people are getting close to ordination. And I want to try and explain why. See if I can explain why, actually. I think for that practice to go deep, for it to really sort of make a mark on us, you need a bit of a foundation. You need to be plugged into yourself. You need to be a little bit emotionally alive, again, emotionally connected with yourself. And there needs to be this element of something sustained. I was saying yesterday or the day before that what ordination, what you're looking for at ordination, is just a marker that people are engaging with what creates skillful mental states and doing that in a way that's sustained. And I think for this sort of practice to really go deep enough, there needs to be that sustained capacity for attention to your experience. So in a sense, it tends to come at the point where you're looking at serious, engaged, sustained practice. And very, very simply with six-element practice, you're just looking at all the elements of your experience, and it's a lachanas practice. You're saying, is there anything in this that's, you know, the hardness of my body, the liquid element of my body, the breath coming in and out of my body, the things going through my mind, anything in my experience that's permanent, anything in my experience that's permanently satisfying? And then the instruction is, if not, what would it be like to let it go, to not hold on to it so tightly? And you get this sort of paradox. I think we're so used to identifying with our experience that the idea of letting it go creates a wee bit of anxiety. You think that you're letting go. Well, that's me. You know, like if I let go of me, I disappear. But actually, the experience of it, like some of the texts talk about, that what's awareness like when it's not caught in a tight, bound, limited mental state? What's awareness like if you've got that flavour of letting go? And some of the traditional texts talk about it in terms of luminosity, in terms of radiance, in terms of spaciousness. So it's not a letting go into nothing. It's a letting go from what traps us, what constrains us. But just that flavour, it's an inquiry. If it's impermanent, you can't hold on to it. If you don't hold on to it, what's awareness like with that sense of non-clinging, that sense of opening into something that's not so tightly identified? So six-element practice, the spiritual death, is death in the sense of that tight holding on to an identity and a sort of relaxing into something bigger. And then the next stage is, as you let go, as you create that space, something deeper starts to emerge into it. And Sangharakshita talks about that in terms of spiritual rebirth. Again, to try and be kind of concrete about this, that in some of the more sort of vipassana, some of the more insight practices, that the thing that comes after the letting go is, well, in the six-element practice and in the Anapanasati Sutta, they talk about viragati. And viragati is the mind not passionately attached. So it's this sense of the mind disentangled, and then it goes from disentanglement to the mind liberated, and the mind knowing that it's liberated. So you get quite a kind of conceptual description of it. But if we haven't had a strong experience in that, you listen to that stuff and there's no real experiential sense of what it's getting at. So traditionally, this is where one of the main practical approaches to this is bringing to mind the experience of the Buddha. So it's in this place you've started to open up a little bit. There's a little bit less tight self-identification. The awareness is more open. There's something starting to emerge. And the traditional language for that is the language of the kindness of the Buddha, the awareness of the Buddha, this experience of calm, this experience of compassion, but an experience that comes outside our act of will. It's an opening up to something bigger than us, deeper than us. And that more symbolic language, that sort of receptivity to the image of the Buddha, is one of the traditional ways of trying to state the positive content of the experience when that letting go happens. You're not letting go into nothing. You're letting go into a blue sky out of which emerges the image of the Buddha. So that's the stage of spiritual rebirth. And then the last stage in the five spiritual faculties is virya. But virya Banty translates beautifully by saying spontaneous action for the benefit of others. There's been this opening up. You're not so tightly identified by yourself. There's not this conscious act of willing. There's a natural unfolding of deeper, more positive mental states, as you notice very early in your practice. And that expresses itself in spontaneous action for the benefit of others. So basically, if you wanted a quick summary of what the Dharma practice looks like in Sri Ratna, it's nearly the two verses of the Dhammapada. It's not that complex, actually. So Banty and what is the Western Buddhist order raises this question about what's the fundamental philosophical position of Sri Ratna. So the fundamental philosophical position of Sri Ratna is the fundamental philosophical position of the whole Buddhist tradition, that things arise in dependence on conditions. That within that, there's a tendency, a current towards liberation. That we can bring attention to that current towards liberation and cooperate with its unfolding. And that unfolding is going to happen in five areas. And Banty says, this is what your practice means. It means that as best you can, you keep up the effort to be aware of yourself as far as you can during the day. You keep up the effort to stay in a positive, kind, emotionally open mental state. That you stay connected to that deeper, clear seeing of the nature of your experience. Just looking at that arising and passing and keeping the space around it. That you try to apply at every level of your activity that flavour that you've got from those moments of deeper seeing, and you do what you can to help other people. And he says, basically, that's on the practical side all that you need. You're attentive to your awareness of yourself, emotionally open, not clinging to it, receptive to something deeper, letting that inform your experience, and do what you can to help people. He says, if you're doing that, you don't need to worry where you are on the path. That, at whatever level you're working, whether you're connecting to your body or letting go into non-clinging, those are the elements that you're practically working with. So that engagement with that is going for refuge to the Dharma.